Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Viewers of this program have certainly come across the observation that Ukraine is on its last legs. Indeed, Ukraine's battlefield situation is grim and worse by the day. However, it needs to be asked whether NATO is on its last legs. The answer is certainly no. Crosstalk in Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest Garland Nixon in Washington. He's a political analyst. In Lebanon, we have Angie Wong. She is a journalist and co-host of The Final Countdown on Sputnik International. And in Istanbul, we cross to Tariq Cyril Amar. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Before we get started, folks, you know, I want to express my great happiness that Julian Assange has finally got his freedom back, an abomination of justice that never should have happened. Julian Assange is free. That means the rest of us are free. So now on to business. Tariq, you know, when I was thinking of doing this program last Friday before the events that happened over the weekend, the attack on civilians in Crimea and the terrorist attack in Dagestan. And, you know, I keep coming across Ukraine is on its last leg, its last legs. I've been hearing this now for quite a few months. Now, indeed, it may be on its last legs, but that's not what this is all about. This is about NATO trying to inflict a strategic failure on Russia. This is what it's about, not Ukraine. Go ahead, in Istanbul.
Yes, I think that is the main issue, and that's why it's very difficult to predict when this war will finally end. If Ukraine were on its own, then the war would have ended with a Ukrainian defeat a long time ago. And I think we should even be more comprehensive. This isn't just about NATO. This is also about the EU, which has turned itself into sort of a NATO appendix. And it's more generally about the West in general, right, under the leadership of the United States, which they can't shake off and don't want to shake off. And unfortunately, if you look at various moves that have been made in the EU concerning financing, concerning readiness to try to keep this war going for years if they can, and if you look at various moves that has been tried in the USA, although there the situation is actually less stable, we can't predict if this will succeed. But what I do see in the West is an intention to keep going, if necessary, from their perspective, for years. There are, of course, issues with this. For instance, that the Ukrainian, European industrial base is just not sufficient or is not the right industrial base for war economy, even if they've been using the term now for at least over a year. The European armies are actually not very good at turning money into combat battalions or into combat capabilities in general. This is very well known. Even The Economist acknowledges it, though they can throw money at the problem, that doesn't make them necessarily more powerful. They have recruitment problems. And of course, my last point would be that whatever the collective West wants to do still in Ukraine, they have to work with Ukrainian manpower, at least for now, if they don't want to escalate even worse. And Ukrainian manpower is limited and has been strongly diminished. And that's, of course, the context in which we see already discussions being initiated in Ukraine, certainly to prepare people of lowering the mobilization age once again. It's at 25 now. Now we get talk about 21, and I think people will try to lower it even further. If the collective West will have its will, then Ukraine is going to bled dry even worse than has already happened before this is over.
Yep, and it seems as if that is not a major concern of its Western backers, remarkably. You know, Angie, what we can see, when I started seeing this, when the tide of the conflict became quite obvious in Russia's favor, that terrorism would be used, and we saw that over the weekend, particularly, and the Russian authorities have made it very explicit. The defense ministry is usually very, very, let's say, mum. They don't like to talk a lot. They give a lot of numbers, but they don't give context. This time they gave context. This was an American military ammunition missile that was guided by Americans. Maybe a Ukrainian pressed the button, but this is something the United States is a part of the war. And they've made it very clear that they will react to it. I didn't use the word retaliate, but they will react to it. Go ahead, Angie.
Yeah, and this most recent terrorist attack comes only a few weeks after the big terrorist attack at City Hall, if you remember that, in Russia. So you're going to see this more and more often because clearly the Ukraine is losing its ground. Remember, it was just about a week or two ago that Zelensky had his supposed peace summit, right? That really ended nowhere. And then immediately Russia came out and said, look, we're ready for peace, and Putin did his Asian tour to make sure he assured his allies in Asia. So all of this is push-pull, and the latest, you know, being a terrorist attack, it's been identified that U.S. military weaponry has been used in that terrorist attack, so the U.S. has a lot to answer for in that respect. You know, we're still in the fog of war. No one's actually claimed responsibility for the latest Russia attack in Crimea, but the problem is, you know, you have an incoming new Secretary General of NATO coming in, Mark Rutte, right? And he is a Ukrainian kind of sympathizer. So it almost feels, and he comes in October of this year, it almost feels as if NATO is kind of Ukrainian-proofing itself. In the event of a Trump administration coming in the following January, should Trump win, because Trump has already said he is not for this, and he is certainly not for NATO continuing
war. I'm not so concerned about that, Angie, because they did impeach him while he was not president. So, Garland, what's to stop Congress from impeaching him before he becomes president? I mean, it's neither here nor there. Departmental consensus that counts here. Unfortunately, democracy doesn't. But staying with you, Garland, I mean, obviously what NATO wants is Russia to react very harshly to the attack on Crimea over the weekend. They're not going to get what they want. They're going to be disappointed. It will be asymmetrical. It may not even be in the region. But one thing, if I can give my opinion, I think that Western drones should be driven out of the Black Sea altogether. That may be what they may do. Garland.
Yeah, I think that Russia will take action, I think, by arming or helping to supply and advance the military interest of some of their allies and U.S.'s adversaries. I think that's for sure. And I've felt all along, you know, that Russia is winning, and they will maintain course and speed, and they will continue to win. The reason they understand that the reason that they're getting this desperation from the U.S. empire is specifically because they're winning. And the U.S. empire is trying to do something to throw them off their game, to get them to react in a way that's different than they're reacting now, because what they're doing is working. I think that the Russian leadership understands that the way they fight, they're fighting this war is to exhaust their adversaries, to destroy the capability of the West to utilize to continue to utilize Ukraine as a, you know, as a weapon against Russia. And they're going to continue doing what they're doing, understanding that if they keep doing this, that they're going to have success. The only thing that can slow their success is if they react to some of these provocations and alter the successful course that they're on right now in Ukraine.
Well, Tanik, you know, going back to something you said earlier, I mean, this is part of a much larger plan. You know, if you look at Russian history, I mean, at least it's modern history, threats have always come from the West, okay? And this is just the continuation of it. This time, it is the entire industrialized West. That wasn't always the case when we think of the Third Reich or Napoleon. So this is a Western design. We have to remind our viewers, when you look at Western imperialism, there's only one great landmass they never conquered. It's called Russia. Go ahead, Tariq.
You know, I think that if you think in terms of the power that unfortunately is leading the West, to my great regret, I think the Europeans, the EU Europeans, the NATO Europeans should long have rebelled against the United States. But if you think about the United States as leading this West, right? For them, it's not only about Russia, although their focus is now on Russia. They have, for 100 years at least, thought in terms of Eurasia, right? And they have a very clear conception, a very clear, if misguided, conception of geopolitics that sees Eurasia as the location of the pivot of history, the heartland, right? And no power is supposed to be able to exert hegemony in Eurasia. This they apply to Russia. They also apply to China, by the way, right? And in general, the United States has now pursued, again, for at least 100 years, if not a little more by now, a strategy of preventing any regional hegemony anywhere else on the globe, right? Not a global hegemony, any regional hegemony. And Russia is one of those powers that is capable of building a regional hegemony. And this is a desperate attempt. This Ukraine war on the side of the West is a desperate attempt to degrade Russia geopolitically and to deprive it of the capacity of doing this, especially in de facto alliance with China, which is the worst possible nightmare. And I agree with you that the West is this time failing. I mean, obviously the future is unpredictable. I don't have a crystal ball. But from everything that we've seen over the last 2 years, a little more than 2 years, this Western attempt hasn't worked on any plane. It hasn't worked militarily. It hasn't worked economically. It hasn't worked diplomatically. They haven't shredded the Russian economy, which they tried. They haven't isolated Russia internationally. And the proxy war in Ukraine, so to speak, the cutting edge, where they would have had to defeat Russia really on the battlefield, hasn't turned out this way either. And right now, I agree with the Russian Minister of Defense. He recently said it a few days ago. Right now, Russia has the initiative all along the front line. And I do think, as one of you has said, I'm sorry, I can't quite remember who, but I do think that there is an element of anxiety and panic creeping into Western reactions. But of course, for all of us who live on this planet, right, together, that anxiety and panic on the side of the West is a very dangerous phenomenon. It makes them even less rational. It makes them more unpredictable again.
Yes, and particularly when you see your own hegemony diminishing right in front of your eyes at a very rapid rate. This is something that also engenders a lot of panic. I'm going to jump in here, folks. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Angie. You know, Angie, one of the things that I find very frustrating in the Western coverage of this conflict is all the omissions. All of us and our viewers are aware of the address that Putin gave to his diplomatic corps last week. And it's very interesting if you look at it. It's long. It was something he actually read. It was very serious. But what was focused on most, which got no coverage in the West, is that searching for and establishing a new security order in Europe. And this is what this is all about from Russia's position. It's not about land. You know, it's not about expansion, as you always hear. Is that how can all of us live here together where we have security that is indivisible? I know that it was a popular term when I was coming up, but you almost never hear it now. And it's something that the West willfully ignores. They want victory. They want to crush. They want to destroy. Russia says we need to have security, and when we have security, we can have peace. That is an element you never hear in the West. Angie.
No, absolutely. And by Putin saying that, it completely destroys the Western narrative that Russia's the bad guy and we're the good guys and we're helping Ukraine defeat the bad guys. They need to create this narrative mainly for the military complex, right? The industrial complex that they keep feeding, Congress keeps feeding money to. Remember, so much money has gone into a lot of these defense contractors and military producers that, you know, a lot of these equipment and things that we're buying won't be produced until at least 2029. So, you know, it's unfortunate that the Western media is not giving the coverage to Putin, and that's why he himself gives these press conferences, reads them out loud, and puts them online wherever he can. But, you know, this is a propaganda war, and at the moment, he doesn't have an outlet for the world media.
Yeah, well, it's called Western censorship, okay? I mean, as I was going to the studio, it looks like the EU is going to try to ban Telegram, okay? The EU is becoming more and more like the Soviet Union every single day. Garland, one of the things, again, that I find really worrisome is that it seems like the current elites in the West forgot how we used to be afraid of nuclear war. They, you know, the Russians won't do it. They're too timid. They'll back down. Well, as Tadek has already told us, none of those things have happened. None of the things that the West thought would happen has happened. And so we all should be very worried about a nuclear exchange because Russia has a huge conventional force. The West doesn't. Go ahead, Garland.
Yes, and what's really dangerous is that the military capacity of the West has declined to a point where they're not even capable of defending themselves anymore. The neoliberal scam that is the Western economic system has hollowed out everything, including the military-industrial complex. So now the leadership of the West, if you want to call it that, these bungling, hapless fools feel they're powerful not because their military can do anything. They understand that their ships are now subject to easily being attacked by hypersonic weapons, etc. But the only reason they feel strong is because they have nuclear weapons. That's all they have to rely on is to swallow a suicide pill, and that's what makes it dangerous.
Yeah, but I mean, Garland, doesn't that tell us that you can go up the escalation ladder pretty quick, considering what you just said?
Right, because when you have nothing else, when you have no other way to defend yourself, that's the only thing that you can go to in the event of a conflict, because you're going to lose on day one militarily. So what do you do on day two? You swallow a suicide pill. And I might add this, that the ruling elite is now totally and completely estranged from the masses and the working class. You need only look at what's happening in the elections in the United States and in Europe, in the UK, in France, et cetera, to understand that the people have had it with these people.
Yeah, but Tadek, I agree exactly what Garland said, but that's all the more reason for the quote-unquote war economy, giving more power to Brussels, degrading the sovereignty of the EU members, NATO directives about being able to move troops through EU countries. I mean, this is part of the project, too. This is the creation of the United States of Europe that so many people want, and most in Europe don't.
Well, the thing about the European Union is that from its inception, really, in the 1950s, it's been a very elitist project, right? And as an elitist project, it's done certain things effectively. It's built a common market. It's good at bureaucracy, as far as one can be good at it. But at the same time, it has always not been democratic. The European Union is simply not a democratic setup. It's been designed to give much more weight to elites that come from the various member countries, but that lose actually any democratic accountability that they may have still at home once they become European Union elites. That's the trick of this whole thing. And at the same time, what we have seen recently is that it has become especially brazen and shameless about subordinating itself to the United States, to Washington, right? And Ursula von der Leyen, of course, is the key figure here, but she is by no means alone. And Josep Borrell is not much better, even if he sometimes strikes a slightly different tone, right? So these are two ways in which the European Union is an institution that actually alienates itself quite systematically from the Europeans who actually live in it, right? Its inhabitants, the citizens who live in it. And you see rebellions against that. But the point is, what happens to the rebellions? One was in Italy, and it led to the election of Meloni. And by now we have the verb Melonify, right, which stands for you get somebody from the more or less far right getting into power, and they are then absorbed by going along with all these pro-NATO, pro-American policies. Yeah. The next big case where this might be the question, and we don't know how it will end, could be France, right? At the end of this month, very shortly, we have very important elections there. If France goes to the Rassemblement National, right, to their far right, then there will be the questions, will they be Malonified, right? Maybe not. Maybe
well,
not.
Well, you know, when you mentioned Meloni, you know, yeah, they all worried that she was going to be the next Mussolini, and she ended up being the next Tony Blair. So
Exactly.
I don't put a lot of stock into that, but I see your point.
Yeah.
But, you know, Angie, this is one of the most interesting aspects of this, and it's something that I've had many of my guests discuss, is that, you know, you have these European elites that are so subservient to the United States when it is not in their security interest. I've always said, you know, people say future historians will explain, but I think it'll be future psychologists that'll have to explain how this happened. Go ahead, Angie.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's the legacy, kiss the ring of the U.S. president. I don't know if that's going to happen anymore. I mean, we've seen Joe Biden perform with European leaders the last few weeks, and he's not performing very well. So but it is legacy, it's tradition, and I understand the respect of countries. But I think my colleagues on this program is absolutely correct. I mean, you see all of Europe and other countries around the world going far right, and it's just the pendulum swinging from left to right now. Are we going to find a center? Are we going to find some sort of common sense? I'm not sure.
Well, Angie, I've always had a problem with the far right, but I get your point here. It seems to me more and more people just want to run away from the neoliberals, okay? I mean, if that's far right, I can go for that, okay? But there are many people on the left, traditional left, that I see eye to eye on so many issues. It's these people in power and their ideology. I mean,
obviously.
this is a convergence that's going on here, Garland, we have to go back to what working people need. I mean, that's been absent for almost 50 years in the West. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we have one of the things that's happening is an ideological realignment, wherein the traditional descriptions of far right and far left and center are changing. We have what would I call an ultra liberalism. Before, people would say ultra nationalism is fascism. Mm-hmm. I argue this level of ultra liberalism that we have has really turned into fascism.
Yep.
I think what we're looking at now, mm-hmm. people like me on what you and may consider the far left, and other people who are considered conservative, who believe, number one, first and foremost, in international stability, which means independence, which means sovereignty, which means understanding that the U.S. is now, it's not a U.S.-led NATO, it's a U.S.-dominated NATO, and it is brutally and coercively dominated, which we see by their actions in blowing up Nord Stream. So I think we're seeing an Orban and we're seeing a Fico say, well, we can agree that our country should be sovereign and that we should have a stable region.
The problem is,
region.
Garland, that they'll cover color revolution, both of them, if necessary. Or worse
in the case of Fico.
I want to ask you, since you're in Istanbul, does Turkey stay in NATO after everything is said and done? And I'm obviously thinking not only of Ukraine, but I'm thinking of what's going on in Palestine and the potential for war in Lebanon.
Look, I'm not actually an expert on Turkish politics. Unfortunately, I don't even speak Turkish. But as you have asked, I see no signs that Turkey is about to radically change its foreign policy. But at the same time, as you know, even inside NATO, Turkey has now for years very much insisted on its own interests and on taking positions of its own. I mean, this goes back to the S-400 issue or questions, for instance. It goes back, as you rightly pointed out, it now has to do with the, as I believe, genocide that Israel is committing against the Palestinians, and that Turkey is at least verbally much more clearly contradicting than many states and other states in NATO. I don't know about any plans to actually change its formal adherence, right? This is a different issue. But I do think that Turkey insists on its sovereignty in a way that, for instance, a country like Canada does not. Or Germany, for that case.
Well, it's very interesting, Andrea. I'll let you end the program here. I mean, we have the election coming up here. How much is Ukraine going to play into the U.S. presidential election?
Well, Joe Biden has a problem with Ukraine and also whether or not to support which side of Gaza. And, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu is set to come to a joint session in Congress next month. And Joe Biden and Democrats have a big, big problem.
Well, Angie, I can't imagine a worse soft power event that you could have, having Benjamin Netanyahu go, as the entire global South is outraged with the way not only the Israelis are behaving, but more importantly, how the U.S. is behaving in all of this. Yeah. All right, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Lebanon, and in Istanbul. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.